You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.
This episode is brought to you by HP Instant Ink. No one is reading your mind, but HP Instant Ink knows when your printer is running low and sends new cartridges before you run out. So you never have to think about ink. For details, visit hp.com/instantinkSpotify. Conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Hello and welcome to episode 146 of the Washed Up Emo podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today, welcome Steve Schultz from Longwave. Steve is also an accomplished music producer, composer for film, TV, and advertising. If you're wondering why Steve is on, I have three reasons. First, when I moved to New York City, the Brooklyn thing was about to blow up, and I was working at a label nearby. A lot of these venues in the city where bands like The Strokes, Yeah, and others cut their teeth. Longwave were around a little bit past that, and I absolutely love them. Second, I was and still am obsessed with shoegaze. The similarities to the long droning emo songs that I also cannot stop emulating is directly related to my love of shoegaze. I would happily quit my job and join a shoegaze band tomorrow. Hit me up. Third, I found out about a half hour into this podcast that Steve's past band, Scout, toured with Sunny Day Real Estate on the How It Feels to Be Something on tour. Are you kidding me? He waited 30 minutes to tell me that? Well, Steve has a very funny story about Jeremy Enoch, and you will want to listen too. To be honest, this one is sort of for me. Over the years, Steve and I have crossed paths through friends and music here in New York City. I know, it's not emo, it's not hardcore, but Steve's music is fucking beautiful, and Longwave Shoegaze is what I'd want to sound like if I ever picked up my guitar again. Why should you listen? Steve weaves a rad story about early New York City, the boom of 2000s Brooklyn, and the lasting effect of that era, it still resonates today. Thank you to the Patreon supporters. You make this podcast possible. If you want to support, head on over to patreon.com/washedupemo. This is episode 146 of the Washed Up Emo podcast with Steve Schultz from Longwave.
Steve from Longwave.
Hey.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're in your studio.
We're here. Yeah, this is
beautiful.
This is where it happens. This is where it happens. in a bunker in Dumbo.
Yeah, right? If it's funny walking around Dumbo when I used to get off on the F train maybe 15 years ago, there was...
You wouldn't get off here.
It would be a bodega and like one spot.
Yeah, I heard stories because off the York F stop, is that where you...
Yeah.
You come off and you kind of do a quick turn and start going down a hill, and apparently there were kids that used to wait with baseball bats beyond the turn. You know, so you'd come out and you can't see. You have kind of a blind spot.
Wow.
They would you know, jump you. And I remember coming down here with my car around that time probably, and for some rehearsal, and I'm sure it was in this building, and I didn't want to park. I was like, I don't feel comfortable leaving my car here. You used to be able to go right underneath the bridge, and I did to turn around. I was like, holy shit, man, this is where you dump the body.
Yeah. I mean, it's Sioux Zoo with Williamsburg. I wouldn't go past the second stop.
I think this is... I mean, I live in Williamsburg and I work here.
But even
here,
the early 2000s, I feel like you wouldn't.
Yeah, I never felt unsafe in Williamsburg.
I felt unsafe here?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally. At night, for sure. And then when I came to look at the studio, I guess five, six years ago now, I remember thinking, I don't want to go down to Dumbo. It's scary down there. And I came down. It was like, you know, people having their coffee on the sidewalk. Yeah,
a little bit different.
What happened here? Like, I think it's more of a quick uptick in gentrification than Williamsburg, because Williamsburg was very, very fast, obviously, but this really was like unrecognizable to me.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's cool. And then you grew up in Rochester, right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So was it?
How do you know?
Come on, I do my research.
Sorry. Okay. Great.
But like with music, how did you get into music when you were up there? Because I grew up in a small town.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Vermont, kind of close to Montreal, but mm-hmm. wasn't like I had shows. Like Rochester, I think you definitely had access to it, but you were also separated a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think Rochester now has more of a scene than ever, as far as I know. I don't know definitely more than when I was there. When I was there, there were bands that I liked and that were good and the people were nice, but I don't know. I had a band when I was like 16 to 18-ish, and I was the youngest.
Scout?
No.
Something earlier than that?
Earlier than that, yeah. The band was called Dizzy Monk.
Good name.
No. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I was just the guitar player. And yeah, we made a CD, and that was a very important thing at the time. But the band broke up, and it was kind of like, I got to get out of here. Like, I can't, you know, I couldn't really, I knew everybody in the city. So it wasn't, you know, that wasn't a good thing to have, like, you know, cause you felt like there's no options.
You just felt you kind of, you did it all in that.
Well, it was just more like, I really felt like I knew, you know, I could have, I guess maybe what would I do? The band I was in had broken up. I could start a new band with the bass player from him or the drummer from him.
Yeah.
But it wasn't right. And so...
Were you singing yet?
No, I was terrified of singing.
You hadn't sung yet?
No.
When did you start singing?
I mean, I sang on like four-track demos, but Long Wave was the first band I sang.
Really?
Yeah.
So when you started, were you ready to?
No, it was terrible. I was terrible, too. We booked shows at... So I was in Scout when I first got here to New York.
When did you move here?
March 98. So this year's 20 years for me here, which is kind of crazy. But yeah, joined Scout. Scout was already going. They needed a guitar player. They had horrible luck with guitar players. And so I came along and I started playing with Scout. And I was very protective and proud of Scout. So I had this other idea to play some of my own songs, because I wasn't the songwriter in Scout. I would only book a shows at like the Bag It In, you know, this place, or what else? Where else do we play? I mean, Sidewalk Cafe. You know, like we would play, and that was Long Wave, and it was just like terrible, awful, but pretty soon kind of got a little bit better, and then at some point I felt emboldened enough to take on the Luna Lounge. You know, that was like a big deal.
Yeah, of course.
Scout was already playing the Luna Lounge. And I didn't want to play the Luna Lounge because I don't want to muddy the waters. And Scout was doing well. Scout was going to get a record deal. Scout had a lot of people interested in the band at that moment. So I didn't want to fuck that up. But at a certain point, I just couldn't help myself, you know. So it kind of started, you know, getting more and more of my life and my attention. So,
but then singing, like, I mean, for you to, if you hadn't up to before that, what were thoughts or what were things that were going through? Like, was there the voices in your head? Was the sound in your head of what you wanted to?
Oh, no. It was like classic where I imagined myself opening my mouth and like Tom York's voice coming out or something, which was not what happened, turns out, you know? So, yeah. I'm trying to remember. The first time I ever sang, like for real, was on the first Long Wave record. And I remember singing it. It was good and bad. The guy that recorded it, Pete Min, I'm still very good friends with Pete, he had all these beautiful mics and compressors. And so that really sounded nice when I was singing in the headphones. Like, it was really nice sounding. So that was good in one way. In another way, I really probably could have used another year of like singing shows and like getting it together before I did that. But, you know, it is that is the history. So
how did you guys get together? Was there any bands or music? I didn't ask that earlier, but sort of like, yeah, how did you guys like, what music did you connect on? What things did you guys all sort of?
Yeah, let me think. So you got to understand. So I was playing guitar with a scout, a band called Magnet at that time. Did a couple shows with. Longley was like a side thing.
Really?
And, well, when I first moved here, I knew I could play the guitar. I wasn't so sure about singing or writing songs or anything. So I just started looking around for people I could play guitar with, and I thought that'd be a good way to meet people. Excuse me. So, yeah, at some point I met Dave, who became the bass player on Longwave, and yeah, we connected on. He was a punk rocker, and I was not, but I liked the music that he showed me. I mean, he turned me on to T-Rex, and I mean, obviously the Clash. He was a big fan of the Ramones, which I was. It took me longer with the Ramones for some reason. The Clash had songs I knew already, you know, so it was an easier gateway. Mm-hmm. But then he played me Combat Rock and Straight to Hell, and I was like, this is a beautiful song. And then from there, you know, I tended to like the more not as raw or something, not as like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Like that wasn't necessarily my thing right away. But
what was your stuff? What was kind of what did you grow up on, or what did you feel like you connected with most? If it wasn't the punk stuff, indie rock, or
it changed. I mean, I wasn't really
formed. I was into Warrant at first.
No, me too. I wasn't formed at that moment. You know what I mean? So like, I was like guitar player, metalhead kid, and then I joined Dizzy Monk, and that singer in that band, he sat me down. He played me all this music. Played me early REM stuff and Pixies and the Smiths and Psychedelic Furs, Jesus and Mary Chain. And he said, you know, listen to this REM solo. And I'm listening to it. It's like three notes. And he would say, why do you, you know, do you think he couldn't play more than that? And like, and I was like, well, no, he probably. He's like, well, why is he doing that? And it's like, you know, you start thinking about it. Well, it sounds really good in the song when he's doing this simple guitar solo. The guitar sounds good. The notes are beautiful. So he's the one that started getting me to think more about, you know, playing guitar like a part of a band or a songwriter, you know, like not a songwriter like you're strumming guitar chords, but like if you are the songwriter, what you want to hear is not, you know. So, yeah.
Which is what you kind of came up on a little bit with, I mean, metal's definitely that.
Yeah, totally. Oh, yeah. And so, yeah, I moved to New York with, like, that was about the time I moved. I was listening to, the Smiths and the Pixies and all this. And then pretty soon it became, like, you know, had a David Bowie phase. Just went through all the learning phases, which I would say are like essential. You know, it wasn't like I was any different from anybody else. I just had to go through them like everybody else.
Yeah.
And like learn about the Plastic Ono Band record or learn about whatever. And so when Longwave started, it was still at the end of, you know, Dave was turning me on to music that he liked. And then I met Shannon, who became the guitar player. And Shannon turned me on to Modest Mouse and things on the West Coast that he had grown up listening to.
What other stuff was he?
He also liked the Pixies. And then he liked, I'm drawing a blank.
But that's cool how you had sort of the West Coast guy, the East Coast kind of getting into stuff.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that, actually, until you just said it. It's interesting. Yeah, Dave was the West Coast, East Coast New York punk guy, and Shannon was West Coast. Shannon was forever telling me we should get over to the West Coast because you could tour up and down more easily, you know. And right away we started touring up and down the East Coast, which I was booking everything. I mean, at a certain point, I just, again, became, like, emboldened. I was like, you know what? I've got these guys that want to do it with me.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to think the songs I write are bad. I realized you could just say you're a singer, and all of a sudden you're a singer. People say, oh, he's the singer. You know what I mean? You just have to say you are. So, that was a big revelation.
So when you were forming the songs, did you feel those different influences, or did you already have the songs let's say just not overall, but just saying those first few songs you guys were working on together as Longwave, did you have, you know, because again, you're coming out as yourself, not as a part.
Yeah.
You're coming with the record and the song to other people.
Right, right. Well, again, I feel like the first Longwave record is called End Songs, and Shannon recorded it, and like I said, the first time I ever sang was, like, you know, into a real mic was on that, and I think that record is not completely formed yet either. It's close. I think the guitar playing is pretty fully developed, but some of the songwriting and definitely the singing didn't get better until the next record, which was the first RCA record that we did. So, and that was also coinciding with we started writing stuff together. So it was more like a band. Like, I came to them with songs. And then at a certain point, when it really got interesting was when they started playing something, the other three of them, without me. And I'd think, well, shit, they need someone to sing now. So I'm going to sing. And before you know it, we're writing something together, you know. So that was...
That must have been a cool moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm sure you can relate to that.
But just to feel that, to know that you've got other people that are connecting and you have all those influences together. And especially at that time, I moved in June of 2000 or July of 2000.
Yeah.
That was a crazy time, you know, for music in New York.
Right. So this would be before that. So
I know it was before that, but I'm saying like that record, you putting that out, like just feeling... There was this sort of,
but that's why I said it's before, because it's important to know. But when we started, I didn't realize the Strokes were starting too. Like, you know, no one, we were all just bands around, and the bands that everyone would be talking about were like the Spin Doctors, Blues Traveler, and there was a band called Wheatus.
I remember Wheatus,
and I didn't relate to any of these bands. You know, and nobody in Longwave did either. We were like, and so it definitely was not like a happening scene at that moment. It was like, I left Rochester. I was like, but this is kind of better because there's a cool club. The Luna Lounge was fun to go to. And definitely, like, the guys in Longwave, I couldn't find people like that in Rochester. At least I didn't know them, you know. So, like, to me, it was definitely cooler, but it wasn't like... it still felt like nobody's getting it, or
no one's paying attention.
Yeah, or like maybe not no one's paying attention, but almost like there's no model, there's no like proof that we can do this. You know, it's like when the Strokes happened, it was like, oh my god, like they're doing it. You know what I mean? And the next thing was, yeah, you know, I guess the Interpol or the French Kicks. I don't know who was next, and then I was like, wow, it's like there's a real. We can do this, you know. It's kind of a bit like when you say you're a singer, all of a sudden you're a singer. It's like, well, we're a band. Oh, hey, look, you know, here we are.
Was it fun being a part of that before that happened? That's what I was kind of getting at. Like, not the moment that everyone knew was breaking, but the moments before. That's almost like more fun because it's a little less. There's not the label guys there. There's not you're just kind of like figuring it out together.
Well, we never had. Label people. The first time we had label people at the show was after the Strokes was happening, and because they were looking for the next one, you know, they didn't want to be left out. And we had our manager was the Strokes' publicist, and
I meant before all that happened.
Yeah.
Just playing shows together with these bands.
Yeah, the best times then. We didn't really play with like. The best times, like, I still knew people from Scout. Like, we were still kind of working with. What we knew already, meaning like we would do a lot of shows not in New York at that time. I booked all these shows in the South and out to Chicago and back. It was amazing. The first year we were a band, we did like 100 shows, and only like, you know, one every 6 or 8 weeks was in New York.
What were those like, the out of state?
They were awesome. They were awesome in like a...
How were they finding out about it? Because remember, the internet wasn't that savvy.
Oh, well, I would just book it, and like most of the time they'd be... Nobody there, you know, or like we would play with the Sheila Divine was one, right? So this is how it would happen. I'd hear about a band we play in Philadelphia and I had no clue what was going to happen, and then we met a band called Busker Soundcheck in Philadelphia. They played in they were from Chicago. Next thing you know, come out to Chicago and play with Busker Soundcheck. And so we're always good at making friends with bands. And so there was a band called Jolene that were from Charlotte, and they taught us a lot. I mean, we were like in college. Not, I don't mean literally in college, but like in band college. We were like interns and learning about these things. Like there's a band called The Red Telephone from Boston. They had a record deal with Warner's, and we met them around this time. This is all before the Strokes or anything. And we met them around this time, and we heard all these horror stories about they made a record and it didn't get released. You're right?
It's yeah.
Like, these were like common stories then. Jolene had a record deal with Sire that like they were on hold. So
wow.
They were touring and touring, but like not sure what was happening. And we would tour with, we would be doing these shows with them. And so you're kind of just learning a lot by watching. And especially with Jolene, the way that their singer and all of them, but their singer named John Crook, the way they went about doing their stuff was totally DIY and but classy. Like I remember feeling like just their interactions with people was always really classy, and I thought there was a dignity to it. You know, even if it wasn't hundreds and thousands of people at the shows, you could still, you know, leave people thinking like, I'm happy we met that guy and those guys in the band. And so even back then, there was like, I think we were just kind of learning, and like these kinds of things would serve us well later when like we would get a record deal, and then we were not expecting to take over the world, and we did not blow through the money, and we tried to, you know, we were just lucky in a lot of ways too, but we, you know, try to do the right thing all the time, and not wind up fucking ourselves at the label and having them shelve our record or something. Yeah. You know what I mean?
But that's interesting. You talk about like that time before and learning from those bands, because yeah. Now it's a text, it's an email. And I just, it's interesting when you spend, even if it's a night,
yeah.
It lasts. And ooh. I love being able to converse with people back and forth through yeah. The internet, but that touring element of it and putting in that work in that time period,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think somehow I feel like that's, you get more experience. I don't know. You're in the classroom versus the online class.
Totally. Yeah. I'm still friends with all those people. So it's.
I'm not saying you don't get friends from the internet, but there's something of learning and you're in those same moments of you're wide eyed.
These are like army buddies or something. You know, yeah. Like we. I do text the singer from Jolene every once in a while, and there's stuff that only we know. You know what I mean? Like bands, like when things aren't going, if things aren't going well, and sometimes they won't, right? Go well. So like, it's good to have your people that would go to the mat for you, you know, and they were them, and we were them for those guys, you know.
Yeah.
So there's stuff like I could text him right now and I could say, you know, the other bands that we didn't like at the time, or like a shitty club that we played would never go back to. And it just felt good to be like, well, you know, that sucked, but at least we were there together. And I remember touring with those guys and having walkie talkies, one in each van.
Really?
Yeah. And like, you know, like driving in the middle of the night kind of thing after a show or something, and like silent in the van, all of a sudden you hear, you know, you know, the walkie-talkie's going, and here someone comes over the thing going, "Living After Midnight." You know, it's like sitting on the floor singing, you know, or like looking over at it, and you realize it's the bass player from Jolene, yeah. Like just because he knows we can hear him singing yeah. It. Like, it's just funny shit, you know? It's cool, like, stuff. It's definitely, you know, I never went to college. My family didn't go on vacation when we were from Rochester, so this was the way I learned to deal with people and saw the country for the first time, you know? And then when the record, you know, other things happened, we got to go to other countries too, but it was all with like my best friends. So I was very lucky. And I think everybody in a band can relate to that, you know? I can think of one particular band right now I'm thinking of that, the guy's always the new band, young band. Always talking about who's going to mix this single and mix this and mix that. And it's like, you know, I wish you the best. It kind of would do well to just go out and play some fucking shows and like learn about, you know, this guy I'm thinking of in particular. Always we'd have arguments about how the Black Keys suck or the White Stripes, this and that. And it's like, dude, those bands earned it, you know? Like, for real. Like, we'd go play the Mohawk Place in Buffalo, and you'd see the White Stripes stickers, you know?
Yeah.
You realize they played here, too, you know, and they played this shitty-ass place. and it just
there's something
it gives,
to that.
Gives you it. I mean, not you don't want to do it forever, but like it doing it definitely gives you a perspective and like a what's the word, like sea legs or something. And so then when things are not going well, it only goes down so deep. You know what I mean? It's not like, well, it's over because so and so doesn't want to mix the single or whatever. And it's like, no, it's not over. You know what I mean?
Do you think the managing expectations and having that, because again, that time period, 98, 99, it's not like you could fill your endorphins with likes from Instagram or retweets. Like you didn't have that. You couldn't just tweet out randomly, like, I'm in Buffalo, and there'd be people, like, you had to have it with from within.
Oh, no, it was much smaller. It was much, much smaller. No, it was more like, God, we're going to go to I don't know where, and God, I hope that same girl isn't there this time.
Yeah.
You know, much, much smaller and more personal. But at the same time, like, we were meeting people and, you know, another place, like, God, I hope that other girl is there that time. You know, yeah. Like, you're making these kind of relationships that might last for a long time.
Yeah, I think, too, I think it's a fun time, and we talk about it a lot on the podcast of just this sort of, I call it pre-Bleed American, post-Bleed American, and not just because of the music or the band, but just the way that things were consumed. Jimmy Eat World's Record.
Yeah.
That broke a number of things. Mm. One, they were an independent punk, like, kind of band, and now they're sort of this giant thing, and it sort of opened up a world. The same thing happened in your world, but I think that also was the time when the internet sort of, like, my first jobs, it was like internet marketing, and we were stuck in a corner room and have fun with that stuff. And now there's departments of, you know, hundreds of people doing those things at the same place. So
totally.
It was an interesting watershed moment that way too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. Megan took me to see Jimmy Eat World at the Bowery. And
it's probably at that show.
Yeah. It was the when that record was happening.
Oh, it was definitely at that show then. Yeah,
and I remember the way she had described them. I had not heard them.
You'd not heard them at all.
No, and I went to the show and I thought, this doesn't jibe with what I remember her telling me they were like. Like, this band seems like major label. She was like, no, they're totally like DIY underground emo kind of band. I was like, I don't think so. This sounds like, you know,
straight up radio rock.
Totally. Yeah. Which was totally fine, but it just was not what, you know. So it's probably what you're saying, which is like they were this kind of thing, and then they leaned in this other.
But, and then the internet era too.
Right. Yeah, I think, when was that? That was probably, if Megan was there, it was probably around the time.
It was late 2001.
Around. That was probably one of the last. My memories kind of go into a bit of a long wave bubble around then.
Why?
Because we were just working. At some point, we got a deal, and we had to make a record. We're happy to make a record. And from that moment on, for like a couple of years, that was really all I was thinking about.
It was just a blur.
Yeah. Well, we were on tour for 13 months straight. Like, it was it was our job, and we were doing it all the time. So there are a lot of people, like, I didn't talk to the Jolene singer for a couple of years, you know, just not because I didn't want to.
Yeah.
But I don't even know if I had a cell phone yet. You know, it was like, excuse me.
Yeah, I didn't have one until I moved to New York.
Yeah, like, but I don't remember when
I having one then.
Yeah, so it was harder to get a hold of people, you know, and then so it was pretty much like, I think I remember, I was getting like phone cards to call home and stuff. Yeah. So it wasn't like now where you just call your buddy and you can still keep in touch. It was like I kind of lost touch with a lot of people around that time for just because I was working and then reconnected later, you know.
So from the RCA stuff, was it... were you, I mean, definitely there was a sound, you know, and a lot of bands. And
from RCA?
Just New York. Were you apprehensive about being lumped into it? Were you happy about it? Was the genre tags that people
No, I was just unaware. I was in the bubble, like I said. So I was not objective. I thought we sounded so much different from the Strokes and... How, you know, part of me was definitely happy if anyone would write or talk about us, but another part would say, well, they're not listening to the music. We are obviously different from the Strokes. We're obviously different from these bands. And then I remember being in H&M or something in Europe somewhere on tour, and like Matchbox 20 was on or something, and then the Strokes came on in the same store. And I remember hearing it and thinking it sounded like us, and it was hard to explain the song.
Interesting.
And then I realized it was the Strokes, and I realized, oh, we really kind of do sound more like, I mean, when you compare it to the rest of the world,
yes.
Like I was very myopic. I was very like in New York and in within my little bubble, we are so different, you know? And then once you pan out a little bit, it's like, not really, you know, obviously there were differences, but there was a, you know, kind of a scrappiness or something, or a lo-fi-ness or something. Even the Yeah Yeah Yeah's first record sounds amazing.
Megan brought me to their first show at Mercury.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
She was like, come see this band.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and you opened up for the Liars, I think.
Yeah.
But it was like, yeah. You saw it in that moment. You were like, well, this is a little piece of it. It was cool to see those moments happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't see them until they were playing Irving Plaza. And I don't remember. It was before their record was out. Their EP was out, but the record wasn't out yet. And I remember that was the first time I heard Maps. I remember that song was in my head for weeks. And
wow.
It wasn't out anywhere or anything. I just remembered it from the show. And I remember we went to the Reading Fest. Longway was doing that. So yeah, this is like, there are like bits and pieces during this time that I remember, but this was when Longway was working a lot. And I remember being at the airport, going to the Reading Fest, and there were Nick and Karen. And I was like, oh shit. You know, and Nick, Shannon knew from around Williamsburg because he was a Williamsburg guy forever. And we started talking, and they were very, very sweet. And I said, what's that song? I saw you guys play. That song's so good. And he said, oh, yeah, it's called Maps. And I was like, man, that's a good song. And, you know.
That's so cool.
Oh, man, it was great. I mean, obviously, that song's a classic. So, but I didn't see them play it at a tiny little club. Irving Plaza's a little club, I guess, but it's not a little club.
Yeah, 1,000 people.
Yeah. So, but that's what I remember from that show. Yeah, I've got I'm lucky to have those memories. You know, the first time I saw Interpol was at Mercury.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And I didn't know who they were.
Someone just asked you to go?
I'm trying to remember what happened. I think I saw the band before them. Maybe it was with Megan. I don't remember. What I do remember is that they came out and opened with, was it Obstacle 2, the second song on the first record of theirs?
I can't remember.
With Television, guitar, and I remember that Carlos, the bass player, there was no bass for like the first minute and a half of the song, and then he comes in and it's like, oh my god, this is the best bass playing ever. So, you know, I remember he was loud and it sounded so good, and I thought, who are these guys? These guys are fantastic. And I remember whatever song they played, the second song, I didn't like as much. And I left thinking, I'm going to leave because that was the perfect song.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I only saw one and a half songs of Interpol the first
You're
time.
You're like, I'm out.
Yeah. Next time I saw them was Reading Fest, same as us. They were on the same stage. They hadn't really hit yet.
Did you feel close between the bands?
Depends on which band.
That's what I mean. Like, were there ones that... like because
The Strokes.
Though you guys were closest with them?
Yeah, because of Ryan, their manager. Ryan introduced us. Ryan was a good friend of mine. Ryan was also a huge supporter of Long Wave and a lot of bands at the time. Ryan was great. Ryan, you know, he really saw it before anybody else did. He had the Mercury, and he was booking the Mercury, I guess, if anyone listening doesn't know. But he would book... you know, the AAS, the lot before, you know, who's had the job right before Megan, if you don't, you remember.
Yeah.
So, he had the French Kicks come in, the Realistics, the Interpreters. I'm trying to think who else we would have. He had us come in, and it was all really good bands. And he just saw it before anybody else did. But so he was very nice to us and to me. And through him, we met the Strokes, and they were just, you know, dudes. And then I think when the Strokes started really happening, the Strokes guys were happy to know some other bands that they liked enough to take on tour that I think they also felt comfortable with. I think they felt comfortable with us. No one ever told me this, but because we knew them before. And
you weren't going to treat them any differently.
Yeah, or like ask for anything. we were happy just to be there. You know what I mean? Like, we weren't going to ask for anything more. The first, I just remember this recently, the first long wave tour with the Strokes was the first Strokes headlining U.S. tour.
Oh, wow.
And everybody was so green that we were all sharing the same dressing room. Like, we were in the Strokes dressing room the whole tour. We started in the South, went across the bottom, wound up in California, and they did that $2 bill show that they did with the Elvis stage. And I remember after that they did a San Diego show that was a fucking train wreck, and Julian was wasted. I sang a couple songs because he couldn't fucking sing.
Wow.
Harmar, superstar, was there. He sang a couple songs because Julian couldn't sing. Yeah, it was us, Harmar, and the Strokes. And but the point is, we were all sharing a dressing room until the last date of the tour, and the tour manager said, "Hey guys, you know Julian, he's not feeling great, and you know, could you guys give him some space?" And I realized, oh yeah, okay, right, we got out of here. But like, we were all so green, there was like, we were just kids.
Let's just hang out together.
Yes, total kids. And so I think that's why the Strokes would have us and the Realistics and some of these other bands from the time, because this is what they knew.
This is what they
knew.
And
they were kids too. They were younger than us. They were like 21. Nick was like 19 or something.
I mean, that's that DIY sort of, we want to bring people we are friends with and we want to help.
Yeah, yeah, they were
and
really
supportive.
And if someone
goes up, they want to bring people with them.
Yeah, yeah, they really did for us and for a lot of the friends' bands. So I'm sure you remember, there was a lot of, at that time, there was a lot of jealousy and of the Strokes, like bands that were like, well, only models and label guys go to their shows. And I was like, well, that sounds fucking good to me. I don't know what the problem is. I'll go hang out with some models and talk to some label guys. Maybe something cool will happen. Yeah, yeah. You know? So I not that that was the case anyway, but it was just like, I don't know what the problem is. And so when I had built up in my mind what the Strokes sounded like, because the other guys in Long Wave were always, they would go out and they saw the Strokes before I did. The first time I saw the Strokes was Mercury. It was sold out. I had met them before that, and we had hung out together, but I'd never seen their band.
That wasn't the shitty Beatles show, right?
No. This was
the
residency.
The residency.
Yeah, the four shows. Ryan asked us to do a residency show with the Strokes, opening for the Strokes. And at that point, we were doing our own shows on like Fridays and Saturdays at Mercury. I was like, well, I'm not playing. Fuck that, you know? And Ryan was like, well, are you sure? It's going to be a good show. And I was like, no, you know, we'll wait, do another one. He's like, fine. And I show up and it's sold out, line down the block. And I was like, you know, stupid, you know. But I had built up in my mind what the Strokes must sound like, because at that time there were some like garagey bands in New York. And I had almost dismissed the idea of the Strokes. And then I saw them at that Mercury show. And I remember they played Hard to Explain. And that was the song where I was like, oh my God, like this is no joke. Like, this is whoever wrote this song is fucking serious, first of all. And these guys can all play. Like, the guitars are, everything's arranged like a finger joined cabinet. You know, he's like this, you can't see my fingers, but like, you know, they all fit together so well.
Yeah.
Interlock, thank you. So, yeah, I was completely blown away. And I remember after, like, coming off the stage, Julian was drunk and he gave me a big kiss and like, nice to see you, Steve. And I remember thinking I was changed by the Strokes. In my mind, I was like, I can't look at you guys the same way now because I know you're this good. And then, yeah, the next time I saw them was they were headlining the Hammerstein Ballroom.
Wow.
And I had not seen them personally in a while. And I went with the guy who became the drummer in Long Wave. We needed a drummer. Their publicist had become our manager. He was trying to get us a deal through the people, you know, he knew. We had this EP, Long Wave. Needed a drummer badly. Our drummer had just quit because he didn't see the band going anywhere. Then the Strokes thing started to happen, and we needed a drummer. So I called my friend Mike in Rochester. He came down. First thing we did was go to see the Strokes at Hammerstein Ballroom.
Oh, wow.
And we saw the show. Show was great. No interaction with anybody with the Strokes or anything. We left with everybody else from the show, 3,500 people leaving. And I thought, well, that's it. That was cool that I knew those guys and maybe I'll see them sometime, but that's the end of that. I don't know when I'll see them again. This was an enormous show. I never knew anybody that was remotely this popular. like, you know, all the friends I knew in bands were playing the Luna Lounge still at that time. So, like, they were, like, completely gone as far as I was concerned. And I remember distinctly Mike and I were turning around the corner, and this, like, side door of the Hammerstein opens, and it's Fab, the drummer from the Strokes. And he opens the door, and he's like, "Steve! What are you doing out here? Come in! Like, what are you doing out here? Come on in!" And I was like, "Oh shit! Okay, come on, Mike, let's go." And so we went in, and it was like a total, like, everything
reunion.
Else. Like, yeah, and this is before we toured. Like, right after that was when Ryan was like, "You know, do you want to do this tour?" And we said yes. And they said, he said, "Right, we also have dates in England. And you do you have anything for sale or anything in England?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, can you get something going on? Because if you can't, we're going to give the dates to somebody else." I said, "Yes, yes, I can get something happening." And I had no idea what I was going to do. But about a week before that, someone had called me at my job on Wall Street. I was working at a back office, weird job, temp job thing. And someone from England had called because they heard about the Strokes and Long Wave. And,
wow.
And I just called him back. And I said, "Do you want to put out a Long Wave thing? We need someone to put something out." And
you needed a physical piece.
Yeah, and to get that tour. Otherwise, they were going to give it to someone else, which makes sense. And
yeah,
it also means they're trying to help somebody. And they're trying to help us. So because of that, we really had to get our shit together. And
so you figured out the drummer thing.
Got Mike. Yeah, Mike came and stayed on Dave's couch while we started going on tour. And that was it. We all still had our day jobs. And I remember distinctly being in England. We did the first time Long Wave played London. The first two shows were at Brixton Academy opening for the Strokes, which is 5,000.
What a way to go.
Yeah. And I remember calling my job at like 3 a.m. or whatever and saying, like, I'm not coming back for another week. Like, I'm going to hang out here. My girlfriend at the time flew over. We just completely bailed on everybody after the tour was done. Like,
yeah,
all
yeah.
our jobs and stuff back home. Like, went driving around France. Like, we, like, totally had a whole
oh, that's
thing.
Cool.
Yeah. It was, like, total, you know, lucky to have those experiences for sure. And
but,
then,
that, but I love that, you know, that he opened up the door. He wanted you to come in. I think
yeah.
those things are so important. And
yeah.
sometimes you get that feeling. You leave and you're like, "Well, that was cool, whatever." But for him to then, like, that's when you know that you made a connection and
yeah.
there was a scene.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was, I can't talk about anyone else's experiences, but for us, it was definitely like, you know, we were all under the Strokes umbrella. So, excuse me. I don't know if that makes it a complete scene or not. But for us, it was, you know, it was amazing. You know, we were, like I say, like we were at the Reading Festival and we were playing on the side stage. Interpol was playing too, the same side stage. Strokes were headlining the main stage, you know, whatever, 80,000 people or something. And I remember after they, like, we hung out. We didn't have to hang out. We were done playing for 8 hours. But we hung out, watched them play, go backstage just to hang out with Ryan and the guys in the band. And there's Jack White, and there's Meg White, and there's Ryan Adams, and there's whoever else was playing. Moldy Peaches are there. And I remember, like, just, it was like kids. It was literally people in their, like, ages 20 to 23. And some of them had just played in front of 80,000 people like a half hour ago. You know what I mean? And like the manager of that band is also 23. So it was a really cool moment.
You were figuring it out.
Yeah,
everybody
yeah,
was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think for those sure. those things sort of last, like to see who was in that room. And I bet they were all just as excited to see everybody else.
Yeah. No, everyone was like, "Can you believe this?" No, I can't.
I think the other piece that brings it back a little bit to emo is I think a lot of kids, and not kids, people,
yeah,
loved shoegaze.
Ah.
You know, the Smiths and the shoegaze world, like those kind of like the Brit stuff, like it intersected a lot with a lot of the emotional bands. And I think those bands were listening to a lot of that stuff and it sort of permeated in some of the music. Did you... as shoegaze, did you take that as a genre or were you like, "We're something else"?
Yeah, kind of that, to be honest. But it was more just contrarian nature of anything. It wasn't like, we just didn't know. We would get all these reviews like, you know, obviously influenced by the Icicle Works. It's like, I don't even know who the hell that is. You know what I mean? I never heard of this.
I love that. Yeah. I love you.
Like, obviously influenced by this. And it's like,
You're like, no.
You know, these guys really need to buy another record aside from the Chameleons UK. And it's like, maybe I should buy a Chameleons record, you know? So, yeah.
That was probably really weird to read all those and think that...
No, I just thought they're cooler than I am because I don't know these records. And for me, it was The Edge from U2. Like, he had a lot of echo. And I'm like, I want to sound like that. I got a Memory Man pedal. Still got it right there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was like, you know, and then Shannon had a blue DOD pedal, and that basically got him in the band. It was like he started playing and it sounded kind of cool and weird, and I was like, you're
spacey,
in the band.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like we were emulating something else. I mean, I was trying to emulate The Edge, I guess, but it was really just that's what Shannon sounded like. He had never played guitar before, so he was
interesting.
Yeah. So
and you were telling earlier that you were oblivious of emo at that time, not the popular shit.
I knew
later.
Sunny Day.
You knew Sunny Day.
The Scout had toured with Sunny Day.
Get out.
Yeah, yeah, no,
tell
yeah.
me about that.
Oh yeah,
Steve, why don't you tell? We've been wasting I'm kidding, you can edit this, you can start it right here.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Yeah,
when Steve told Tom he toured with Sunny Day 20 yeah. minutes in.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I just forget these things.
That's okay. That's why we're here.
Right. How did that happen? So I would join, as I said, Scout was my friend Ashen singing in the band, and this amazing drummer named Nigel playing drums. And I joined the band. They had bad luck with guitar players. I joined the band. They already had shit going on. She had a publishing deal with Chrysalis, I think, at the time.
Oh, wow.
Pretty much right after I joined, kind of a bunch of cool stuff started happening for Scout. And I think it helped that they had a halfway decent guitar player now, but they already had kind of stuff in place, and all of a sudden it was like, right, now we have a complete band. Things started happening. Kind of like Long Wave a couple years later when Mike joined on the drums. Mike was a fantastic drummer, and it was like all of a sudden... It felt like we're ready, there's no more, this isn't the learning period anymore, like now we're ready to play, you know, really, really do it. So that was where Scout was at that time. So Scout, somebody, I can't remember how it happened that they met someone related to Sunny Day, but we opened an Irving Plaza show for them for Sunny
Day. What year was that?
98.
Wow.
End of 98, I think.
So that was the How
September.
It Feels record.
Yeah, How It Feels to Be Something On. Yeah. Yep. And I remember watching them sound check and William playing drums and being like, Jesus fucking Christ, that guy, it's too loud. Too loud. Calm down, buddy. So, and I also remember that was the first time I experienced up close, like, the cult of Jeremy Enoch. Like, Enoch,
yeah.
Someone, Ashen had told me, like, you're going to see, like, all these fans are going to ask you, do you know Jeremy? And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. And I was like, no, people really were like, does Jeremy love Scout? Like, how long have you known him? I need to speak to him. And it was like, dude, like, get away. You know, I don't even know him, you know?
So, that was me. No, I'm just kidding. I was at the show.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. So yeah.
I do remember that tour. I saw it in North Carolina, and you could still smoke. Oh, you can still smoke anywhere.
Wait,
there.
Did you see at
Cat's Cradle?
We were there. We opened the show.
Get the fuck. That's it. Now yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember.
Yeah, yeah. Scout was there.
Yes, but you remember the signs up saying "Don't smoke"?
No,
they had signs up that said "Please don't smoke." Jeremy like didn't want to.
Oh, the band put the signs up for the show, not the venue.
Yeah, yeah. The band put the signs up. In North Carolina, Tobacco Road, Cat's Cradle. I saw that tour three times. You guys played North Carolina three. Yeah. You played Raleigh. Carrboro,
yeah.
Winston, and Charlotte.
I'm not sure if we did the other two. Yeah. I remember Cat's Cradle. My memory's a little fuzzy. Ashen would remember.
Yeah, but that was crazy for me to look at the tour dates and be like, are you seriously playing three shows that I can all drive to?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was
in school
at the time, and gas was under a dollar, so who cares?
Oh, yeah.
It was fine. But that moment, I think those tours, you're right, that was like peak crazy for a lot of those fans because of...
Yeah.
And this record was, I think, a lot of people connected on, too.
Yep. And... I'm trying to think if I have any more that I remember about those
shows.
How
many dates were those?
I really don't remember. Not many. It wasn't a lot because I had my day job. Like, we, I don't know how
you
we would have
do
done
so
it.
Many.
Yeah, and Scout was, I wouldn't say dysfunctional, but not entirely functional, if that makes sense. Like, it was a miracle we got through whatever we did with those guys.
So, all right, what other bands did you play with that I didn't know about?
I don't remember. I have to. If we keep talking, they'll come back.
So I talk.
Well, I'm sorry. One more.
Yeah,
there's one more Sunday thing. I did go. Longwave had two brushes with Sunny Day when they did the Rising Tide record. Scout, I think I had left Scout. Scout continued on. They were a band before me, and I left, and they continued after me too. And then years later, we did Scout stuff together again. But when Longwave started becoming more of my thing, I left Scout, and at some point, I saw Sunny Day was playing in New York again, and they were doing a signing, and I went with Shannon, stood in line, brought them a copy of our first Longwave record. And I remember thinking, they're going to remember, and like, it's going to be cool, we did the shows. And they were like, oh, yeah, hey.
Oh, no.
So,
were you totally like,
oh, I was bummed.
Fuck.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And then, but then years after that, Longwave played with the Fire Theft at Experience Music in Seattle. And by then, Jeremy was very sweet, and I don't know if he remembered me from Scout, but he was very much like, well, we know Longwave, and like, great, we get to play together.
It was nice.
So it almost made up for the bullshit.
Great to see you again.
Yeah.
Fuck
yeah.
You, man.
Yeah,
fuck you. I brought my record for you.
Yeah, exactly. No. So that's my history, all of it. That's
I love
not,
it.
I think.
Did you either. Think I? One of my, I mean, when I first heard Longwave, again, I was into a lot of this. I was into hardcore. I was into punk. For some reason, out of all the bands from that, and I was working in New York, I think your record connected with me on a lot. And it wasn't.
This would have been the Strangest Things record, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
And
thanks,
I just feel like if the first notes of like Wake Me Up,
Wake
Me When It's Over, like that is, it's like, it wasn't sad to me. It had this cool feeling to it, if that makes sense. It wasn't like it's sad or it's this. And it was more like, I always say, like euphoric. Like there's these like moments of,
oh, thanks.
Of
I love that.
Sounds that sort of envelop the song. And I think that, especially that record and that song.
Yeah.
Was there anything to that like putting that song together, or was it just the edge?
Well, that was a case for the other three.
And you came in on that.
Pretty much wrote that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because I would have pegged that one as you.
No. Well, they wrote What You Hear, them playing. So that song started in the UK. We did this, we were rehearsing for the Reading Festival or something, at a place called The Depot. And I remember that I went to go get water or whatever I was getting. I went to the kitchen. And the other three guys were rehearsing, like just fucking around. And I had to go upstairs or something to get my water. And I ran to these guys that were in a band called The Libertines. And I didn't, they were no one who, you know, just a brand new band. And they wanted to talk about The Strokes. What are The Strokes like? How is it playing shows of The Strokes? And it was very sweet. And I was like, yeah, they're cool guys. I don't know. They're a good band. And then I heard through the floor, Wake Me When It's Over. At, like the first thing you hear on that record, that's what I heard through the floor.
Wow.
And I was like, this guy Carl's telling me about, or asking about The Strokes.
And all you can hear.
And I'm just listening to Shannon and Mike and Dave playing. I'm like, and I said, hey man, nice to meet you. I gotta go. Like, I gotta go see what they're playing. And so I basically just came in, like the way it comes in on the song is how it happened.
So you literally walked in and started playing that guitar line?
I think so, yeah. I think so.
Wow.
I do remember, you know, like a lot of stuff. I would kind of have the melody and stuff. Yeah, I think the guitar parts just happened right away. That was usually the case. But so, yeah. And then we basically we were doing the Strokes tour. And at the last night of the tour in Dublin was, I think, where I had gotten the Wake Me When It's Over line. And I think I just, you know, there's not many lyrics to the song. I just finished the lyric. I remember singing Wake Me When It's Over in this empty big theater in Dublin called the Olympia Theater. It's kind of built like a birthday cake. It's like different balconies all the way up. Like small but tall, place. And I remember just like singing, thinking, this is like a dream come true. It was, you know, I was thinking about not going back to my job for the next week and like going out with my, going out with my girlfriend out of France. And I was like,
what a cool moment.
Yeah. It was great. So yeah, that was the song. Was the song's good for me too because of all those memories that I have doing it, you know.
And then I see you have all this equipment around. Were you as specific back then of like the sound and how, like, you were definitely like, if it was with the producer, like definitely giving that input and or were you more?
Well, we were lucky because we had a great producer named Dave Fridman that did that record. Still friends with Dave. He's terrific. Dave's a real, really great guy and producer. So, no, we were very, and I guess me, I was very stubborn and probably more than I should have been at the time. Like, I would make our drummer redo the take if the bass drum pattern was off for like one bar. Fucking redo it again. Yeah, and Dave would be like, it's fine, Steve. And I'm like, no, man, it's got to be right. So, you know, I was more on everybody's case than Dave was. Dave had the bigger picture in mind, and but yeah, we were always very particular for sure.
And then with that moment in time in those records and Long Wave sort of time, did you, what were some of the thoughts, like, I guess with it, with you guys ended up breaking up like years later?
Yeah.
Was it the time? Was it everyone was kind of getting older?
Which time? It's a few times. What do you mean? Like when we stopped after like 2009-ish time?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just tired of the band by then. So, I mean, like, so what we were just talking about would be like 2001, 2. And then somewhere around 2003, we put that record out. And then it started losing a little bit of the innocence to it because it became more like
a job.
Not a job, but like it wasn't like the previous year or a little more was like everything was just looking up, 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 up. And, you know, you're always looking forward to, wow, we might get this cool tour of the Strokes. Wow, we might get a record deal. Wow, you know, we might get to work with Dave Fridman. This is amazing. Everything is like a new thing that you're looking forward to. And then when we started doing all the touring behind it, that's when it really became like, you know, you got to do it. We were happy to play live, but it just became more like you get your, I don't know what the word is. This is what leads some people to become jaded about music, because you're just like, you feel like you're just spinning your wheels sometimes. You're not getting anywhere. The shows aren't getting any bigger. People aren't getting along in the band. So
people's,
you know,
tastes change, like the fans, like they, one year, like you're this, and then the next year, yeah, you're on to something else.
Well, we can't control that. I mean, all you can control is our own, what we were doing, you know, and even that was like tough.
Harder.
It was getting tough, you know. So, yeah, the Strokes singer, Julian, says that, let me get it right. He says a band is a great way to destroy a friendship, and a tour is a great way to destroy a band. And so, you know, that started to ring true by the end of, like, you know, over a year of touring on that first RCA record. So, yeah, again, all you can control is your band and your music, and try to, as I said before, like, remain as classy as you can and, like, you know, not, you know, fuck anybody over or piss anybody off, and then, you know, try to keep your relationships good, you know, especially between the members of the band, which is very tough. After this first RCA record, Sony bought BMG, which was the parent company of, wait, I'm trying to think. BMG bought RCA, then Sony bought BMG. I can't remember how. Like, it was like all this consolidation happened, and bands were getting dropped left and right. So all of a sudden, my focus was like, oh my God, we're going to get dropped. We did a show at Irving Plaza. It was our show. It was the only time we've ever headlined Irving. And we opened with a song called There's a Fire, which became the first song on the next record that we did, and thank God, like, we did that. The A&R guy was there, and like after the first song, us opening with that song, apparently he leaned over to our manager and said, you know, we gotta do another record with these guys.
Wow.
That's a killer song. We just, you know, we opened with a brand new song, and that was the,
but you're
the,
right, that consolidation too of like you've all these bands that were like,
yeah.
Oh, you're done.
And yeah, then, we were just barely surviving. Wow. You know, and you know, we proceeded at that point to make an extremely expensive record that was, you know, probably, and you know, maybe our worst record. You know what I mean? In a lot of ways, I love the songs on it, but it could have been a better record. So after that, there was a period that followed that I was I started doing like guitar gigs with Albert from the Strokes, a couple other things I was doing just to make a living because the band had stopped being able to make me a living. And then we did, you know, got another record deal, another publishing deal, did Secrets Are Sinister, which is the fourth now long wave record. And then
in 08.
Yep. And then Shannon left the band, and that was kind of like the death knell. Like that was, you know, that wasn't resolvable. Is that a word? Yeah, was not able. We couldn't figure that out. Shannon was gone. It was it. So we had some tours set up. We had our friends. We were always good at making friends with bands. So Block Party took us out. Okay Go and Blue October. We met at that time, and we had to, did all that with a guy named Keith playing guitar. Shannon would play in New York, and then it got to be where we fulfilled those commitments, and I had other stuff starting to happen, and I was like, you know what? I'm just tired of this. Tired of, like, you know, carrying the whole thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Not that the other guy's contributions weren't extremely important and like vital, but I felt like I was carrying the whole thing, and I thought I can't deal with it anymore. So that's what stopped it.
And so you have new music.
Yes. Yeah, there's a
Stay
whole new
With
record.
Me is the first song that's out.
Yeah.
And so how did that come about? Everybody said, hey,
the song or the whole thing?
The whole thing. How did everybody say, like, hey, I think we're ready to jam out?
Yeah. Well, Shannon, as I said, left the band in 2009. And he and I had, like, it was the first, like, we had always gotten along great. And that was, like, the first time I was like, I don't want to see you, motherfucker. Like, I don't want to see him. And it took a while for that to mend. And at a certain point, it did. We started hanging out again. And, I love this guy, Shannon, here. So at some point, I'm trying to think of the timeline here. I found out that I was going to be a dad about 6 years ago. And that was the first time Shannon and I were out one night late drinking, having a good time. And I remember it was like 2 a.m. Everyone else had gone home, just me, Shannon and I. And Shannon says, I think we should get the band back together. And I was like, you motherfucker, you know? And I said, I got to go to the bathroom. And I went and came back and I said, listen, I got to tell you, I haven't told anybody yet. I'm going to be a dad. Like, you know, she's pregnant. Like, and he was like, oh. So, you know, there goes that. So it had a lot of fits and starts. We got point we did get a rehearsal space in Williamsburg, sharing with somebody with We Are Scientists, mm-hmm. and we started banging out some new songs. But the space was shitty. It was cold. It smelled. We were unhappy. We'd always just play for a half hour and then just go get food or something. So it never really took hold until about maybe 2 years ago. I had moved into here, the studio where we're in right now. And so I had a space that we could be loud in. And that made all the difference. That was like, now we could do this thing. And I had been doing ad music, TV commercials for like probably 5 years or something at this point, and for a living. And I was starting to, you know, I enjoy doing that, but I was starting to miss like turning up distorted fuzz guitar, you know. So I called Shannon and I said, hey, man, let's do this. Let's try to work on some stuff. So he came out, he flew out, and we did that maybe three or four times. And at a certain point, we realized we were, like, making a record. So, you know, we had all these plans about how to finish the record and stuff, and at a certain point, we decided we're just going to finish it all here. And so that's what we did.
That's great.
We didn't mix it here, but all the recordings, Stay With Me, everything was recorded here.
Rad.
Yeah.
Back again.
Yeah, man, it's cool. I remember distinctly when we first got together in here to play, and we had Christian playing bass. This is another important thing. Our bass player isn't new, newish now. I remember when we all got together to start playing. You know, I'm pretty diplomatic in my work. I have to, if I get asked to do a TV commercial thing and it's like ukuleles and hand claps or something, you know, and it's like, well, yep, sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Great, I'll do it, you know. But I remember when we were all sitting here, you know, rehearsing and fucking around, I can't remember what it was. Someone came up and was like, yeah, that band, this record or something. And like, you know what? I think that record fucking sucks. And I was like, that feels so good to say. You know what I mean? It was like, I could say this with my...
with your friends.
With my friends,
and
you
it's
know?
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and
oh,
know,
that's great.
And I could, you know, tell Jay, I don't really like that drum part you're playing. He could say, well, the guitar part, you know, you guys going to need to work on that, you know. And it was, it's cool to, like, have your pals, you know. So it's...
I mean, you are truthful with your friends.
Yeah.
Because that you
for
weren't...
for better and for worse.
Yeah. So then you alluded to the writing of, you know, for commercials and stuff, and yeah. There's a lot of bands that do that. Adam from Chamberlain does that. Yeah. Josh from Shift and a bunch of other punk bands, he does it in L.A. Yeah. Ben, my old bandmate, does it. Yeah. You do it. Yeah. It's such a rad... it's almost like the perfect tour. You don't go anywhere. You get to go home every night. You're still making music. And
kind of. Yeah.
I mean, you're not touring.
I just, no.
I'm saying like that job, it's not like you need to... Being in a band, making music doesn't involve you having to go anywhere.
Right. Yeah. No, exactly. The best part about it is you get to do your own... at least for me anyway, I'm a freelancer. You get to make your own schedule and you do whatever you want. The worst thing about it a lot of times is like what happened today where like
deadlines.
A deadline comes in and you're just like, well, whatever plan you had, you have to blow it off because you gotta, this is your job, you know, you gotta get
the guy
done.
Needs to get it to tape on Saturday morning and you gotta
I mean, a lot of those times it's kind of arbitrary and you find out later, but you do your best to get everything, you know, that the job is getting it to them on time and being easy to deal with. And then after that, it's making good music for them. You know what I mean? Because
that's a really good point.
A lot of people can make the music, but
they want to see your name and see if Steve. You know, he can make it happen for me.
Yeah,
that person on the phone's already stressed out,
trying to get
whatever they need.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
How did you get into it?
Through the band, through Longwave. I'm trying to remember now. Longwave had a Lubriderm commercial, like 2000, before Secrets Are Sinister came out. One of the songs was used in a Lubriderm commercial, and a friend of ours made that happen, and it was really good money. And the friend of ours said to Shannon and myself, you know, would you like to do more of this stuff? And we said, well, hell yeah, let's do it. And there was never any more money after that point. I did a bunch of stuff for him for free. I was learning how to use Pro Tools. Didn't sound that great yet. I didn't have a real studio. It was like laptop in a corner, and I was just learning. And at a certain point, I felt like I had gotten good enough where I wanted him to give me a little bit of money if he was going to make me do all this work. And I said as much to him, and he said, well, okay, cool. You know, and that was it. He never called me again. So then I sat on that for a while, and then at a certain point, I was at a party, I think, and I saw another guy that had a space next to our old space. And he said, what are you doing? I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I do this stuff for Ed. I said, oh, yeah, me too, which is pretty much a bald-faced lie. I had done it a little bit for free, but it wasn't like I was a professional at it. And so at some point he called me and said, we need a song for a Wendy's thing. And he thought the guy can write a song, me. But I sent him back a fully produced track, and they started calling.
Wow.
So, and I think the second or third time they called, I won. So, you know, I don't know if you know.
Yes.
Yeah, so you're kind of competing.
You pitch, yes.
Yeah, you're pitching. And you get a little bit of money just for trying. But,
like a kill fee.
Yeah, but then if you win, it can be really good money. So I think the second or third time they called, I won the job. And if you're winning now, then they're definitely going to keep calling. Because, you know, these music houses make money when you win too. They, you know, they're not in it for free. You know, they get their money too. So they love you if you're winning. So they started calling and calling, and then at a certain point, our old manager wound up working at this other music house. So he did the same thing, called and said,
that's
can you
great.
Write a song for a Chipotle ad? No problem. Send them back this whole track, and like immediately he's on the phone. Wow, I didn't know you could make it sound like a whole track. Can you did we have this other job, and can you do this? And so, you know, just kind of started going. And this was probably, like maybe 6 years ago or something.
That's amazing.
I don't know, a little more. Yeah.
I love the bald-faced lie, like right in front of that guy.
Yeah. Well, I had
Just love the moment, like you being like, I do that too.
Well, I don't think, I was kind of, I don't remember what I told him, but it was enough. And he didn't call me for like another 6 months, you know. He just remembered it at some time that I had said that, and he needed someone who could write a song for a Wendy's ad. So
that's cool.
It was.
So do you see doing this for a long time?
There's a lot to the answer to that question. The simple answer is, yeah, I would say I like doing the ad stuff. It just would depend on if other stuff happens, you know.
What do you want to do then in music?
Yeah.
I know you're doing Long Wave. I know you're doing this. Like, are there other things you've thought about you've wanted to do, or just in general?
I mean, I think it's just more of the same, which is enough to keep going. Long Wave just did a tour for a little two-week tour, and that was great. I kind of need to keep doing that in some capacity, not all the time, but I need to keep doing that. I think I'm good at it, and I think I like to do it. So it's a balance, because I don't want to be touring for a year straight or something. But on the other hand, we did this tour with a band called Blue October, and I've written a few songs with them now. One of the songs was kind of a little hit for them this year, did really well for them. So now there's a new publishing deal for me between the Long Wave stuff, the Blue October stuff. There's a couple other things that I wrote with other people too. So it you know, I've had a few different publishing deals in my time, and this is a new thing for me to try and, you know, I can't go on tour forever, but I like writing music. I like working with people. So I don't know if I'd do the ad stuff forever. I would like to do this, the other stuff too. The ad stuff is good money. So yeah, I think it'll be
working with people, producing, writing music with people.
Yeah.
All the examples you've talked about, it's been, that friend I saw from this, or this guy was doing this.
It's being
involved, and those things will happen. And I think you're sort of like, I think these are all appreciating because of that.
I think about this sometimes. I think, I don't know if this is what you're saying exactly, but it seems now, I don't know if it's because of social media, or maybe it's just my own experience, but there's a lot of younger bands that try to be more positive than I thought we were. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are bands that we knew back in the day that fought like cats and dogs, and I thought, well, they're not going to last very long because they're going to beat the fuck out of each other. But like now, I know of a few bands that you know, they take care of themselves better. They don't drink as much. They there's like an emphasis on trying to be positive. I think it can go a little overboard. You know, there's a lot of the humble bragging or whatever shit that happens. Yeah. You know, but what I'm trying to say is that I think what we're talking about with like our friends and the bands we're still friends with and people from the past, it's a lot about just being supportive of each other, and it is a bit like a larger community, and staying positive when you're careening through the universe in your life, and it's like you bump up against this person, that person, and you're in your comings and goings, and you say, hey, you know, like, cool, like I heard your new song, great, you know, I'm happy that you guys are doing this, you know. Like the Shield of Vine is an example. You know, I don't talk to Aaron or those guys like frequently, but when I see them, I'm happy to see them. I love hearing new Shield of Vine music. And I will tell them, I'm glad that you're doing this, you know? And I think in a way that is all of it. There's nothing else to it. Like you doing your thing because you want to do it. You know, we're not making this necessarily for, you know, fans to listen to. I love that. I do think about that, but mostly it's like I'm getting my kicks by playing loud fuzz guitar again. And you know, at the same time, you're like just trying to have a positive experience in your life, and so that involves, you know, keeping your relationships good with everybody. Like, how's it been? How are you doing? How are your kids? Like, at this point now, a lot of my friends have kids. Like, I have kids. You know, so it's like, you know, a whole other dimension now of life that's unfolding. When you see these other bands, Blue October guys, like, it's like we get together, we talk about their kids. So I don't know if that makes a lot of sense.
It does. No, life moves on. You have those experiences that you're all dealing with. Like you said, all your friends now have kids. Yeah. Having those chats. But it all sort of music's still around it.
There's still, I guess it's a bit of a community aspect or something, or like a family feeling. You know what I mean? I definitely feel like the Blue October guys and are like a family. I feel like I'm in the circle there.
That's
the Strokes
a great feeling.
Is the same thing. You know, it's.
That's what you all, isn't that what anybody wants? They just want to have, you want to have friends through life, and it's like, it's great when there's music too.
Yeah. That's kind of the order, actually, at this point too. You know what I mean? There's been a lot of times with Long Wave, the new stuff, where it's like, you know, if we all can't do it, that's okay. I'm not going to, like a show comes up, we can't do it. I'm not going to bust everybody's balls. Like the important, like if anyone's unhappy, like we'll stop. Because there's no good reason at this point now to like piss anybody off in the band, you know. So I don't know if that makes sense, but
it does. No, I think it's a good feeling.
Yeah,
like friends, and then music.
Mm. I mean, yeah, it's kind of a, you know, it's a bit like back when we started playing with Long Wave in the first place, you know.
Take me back to the other place. Take me back when I'm alone. I can see all the little things.